This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Richard Grossinger. He's the co-founder and co-editor of a magazine called I.O., literally I.O., and the press North Atlantic Books with Lindy Huff. And what I'm going to be doing in this conversation is part one. Today I'll talk to Richard, and then another day I'll talk to Lindy. And just by way of introduction, I've known both of them for a really long time. I.O. itself is celebrating 50 years since it was first founded and marked by an anthology called the I.O. Anthology, Literature, Interviews, and Art from the Seminole Interdisciplinary Journal, 1965 to 1993, also edited, of course, by Richard and Lindy. Richard, how are you after that lengthy introduction?
Okay. It should be made clear that I.O. is long defunct. It gave rise to North Atlantic Books and overlap briefly with it, but it hasn't been published for many years.
Right, since late 80s, early 90s?
Well, the date on the anthology keys the fact that we continue to publish I.O. anthologies into the early 90s, but the last issue of the magazine was 1976.
So that the you kind of mark the magazine as having a life of about 11 years, but the special issues kind of were an extension of the magazine.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, just to go back to the beginnings of this, I actually, when I read the introduction to the anthology that you've done, I learned some things about the early history of I.O. that I think I might have known at one time, but probably forgot. It started when you and Lindy were juniors in college.
Yeah. It was sort of launched by multiple converging factors that somehow came together and made the critical momentum necessary.
So, I mean, I guess I wanted to ask about that, you know, that early period, but of course you did give the history in the magazines, I mean, in the anthology, so probably not useful or necessary to just repeat that history, but I was really struck by the kind of congruences that occurred, you know, that enabled you to launch the magazine. You had support from your fraternity, but it seemed like the real drive was through your connection with Robert Kelly. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because that seemed to be the spiritual genesis of I.O. really more than anything else.
Yeah, I think so. It's hard to know whether the people listening to the interview would have an appreciation of the different factors that were in play then as opposed to 20 years later or now. It wasn't that obvious to start a publication. And when Lindy and I met Robert Kelly through a high school friend of mine, Chuck Stein, he was publishing his own informal magazine, which was mimeographed and stapled, called Matter. And a few other friends were doing kind of things that were either that funky or a little bit less funky. And it didn't occur to us to start our own. It took other factors. As you mentioned, I belonged to a renegade fraternity at Amherst College, which was being required to start a publication and gave me some money. And Lindy was at Smith and joined in with me. And then we were inspired by what Kelly was doing and kind of given a little bit of a push by him to make our own entry into the literary world by doing a publication. And then I gave a speech. I'd given a speech Halloween of 1964 that he thought should open the first issue and open a kind of range of knowledge that we would then cover in the magazine. So those factors were in play, And then once we started it, other factors came into play. The following summer, we hung out at Aspen Writers Workshop in Colorado, and we picked up work from writers there and then came back to Amherst and Smith and got funding from Amherst College to continue the publication. And then we took it with us to graduate school in Ann Arbor. And the story simply snowballs from there, followed by a mixture of design and fortuitous events that kept leading us to continue after we thought we would give it up. And ultimately, it rolled over into the concept of a publishing company, which even in itself was seen as a kind of small literary venture, not that much different than the press initially. But then, like the magazine, it too sort of hit moments of fortuity and design and kind of grew, dilated upward into this whole kind of not just a press, but a concept that we were trying to articulate through the books of the press as we had through the issues of the journal.
Right, and I think that actually is an interesting theme to explore that, and I'll go back to Kelly, who was teaching at Bard and was kind of a magical figure in some ways at that time, maybe still is, but was he presented to you the notion of publishing the magazine as part of the work of being a writer, it seems.
Right. The work of being a writer was the change he made for us was that the work of being a writer was a psycho-spiritual undertaking. Prior to that, the best that it was a literary undertaking as opposed to a commercial undertaking. But Kelly took that concept and he essentially said, no, it's more than a literary undertaking, it's a psycho-spiritual undertaking. And by making a commitment to the magazine, you're essentially engaging in an initiation into a world of elders. I thought of it not long afterwards as what one missed for not growing up in an indigenous culture and having a real initiation. This was our substitute initiation into adult life and then also into kind of the meaningfulness of the world.
Right. And it struck me as I've thought about that period, and of course I will say that in the same way that Kelly influenced you, I think you and Lindy and Io influenced me in my own work. And I've felt for a long time that ability of the, as you call it, the elder, or, you know, maybe it would be the adult, not necessarily the elders, but adults in the world of writing and spiritual practice were so open to younger people coming into their own beings that, I think that period is really noticeably demonstrates that practice, you know, that it was a form of literary practice for the older writers to bring the younger writers into the fold.
Yeah, I have felt in recent years, especially in the transition that formed North Atlantic Books as only at most a quasi-literary venture, that moved on from literature per se to holistic health and martial arts and direct spiritual practice, mainly Buddhist, but also Western. And it wasn't as located anymore in a literary genre.
Well, and of course, but you know, I remember this, I'm pretty certain that the first time I ever read any of your work was in the San Francisco Oracle, because I don't think I knew about Io until a little bit later in maybe late 60s, but I think I had read Solar Journals in the San Francisco Oracle. And I was thinking about that as you mentioned it in the introduction to this anthology, that the culture as a whole embraced this kind of literary spiritual practice that is the counterculture as a whole, not necessarily the larger culture, and that Io and your work and Lindy's work was part of that larger cultural efflorescence, and that you were pretty aware of that. You were conscious of that as you were kind of growing into yourself as an adult writer.
Yeah, the San Francisco Oracle was roughly 1967, and Lindy and I met you in roughly 1970, I think.
Yep, and 69 or 70, I think.
Right, so not that much of a gap. And Lindy and I, at the time, we were born in 1944, and what year were you born in?
1951.
So you're 7 years younger, so that when that age difference kind of meant something then. I guess we were about 24, 25, and you were about 17 or 18. And now I think of us as not as sort of part of the same generation, but at that moment, you know, we were out of college, you were still in college.
Yeah, that's true. And I looked at what you were doing as you were kind of like part of that generation just ahead of me that had more adult experiences than I had. And I think that for a lot of the work that you did, you were, whether by accident or location or desire, I think you and the magazine and the publishing and the writing that you were doing influenced a lot of people, a lot of writers who and others, you know, just people, readers who were seeking at that time and looking for the ways to connect various themes of knowledge and understanding. And one of the things that I think you did that is significant is joined the pop culture of that time, you know, the rock and roll culture became part of the work that you were doing. It was not dismissed as pop culture, not real, not meaningful. You took it seriously in a way that others, I think, did not.
Yeah, a lot of those themes become more clear this many years later, and we're really talking 50 years later, because of their persistence for me. At the time, I couldn't distinguish myself and Lindy from what dozens certainly of people we knew and hundreds of people we knew of, and we imagined thousands and tens of thousands of people were doing during the countercultural era. All those things seemed different strains of what we were doing. And I didn't think of ours as any more substantial or seminal than any others. But in fact, as the years have passed, it stands out. Our commitment stands out. When you say we were influential, I wouldn't have known why at the time. But in retrospect, I feel as though we were influential because of the depth of our commitments and the sincerity, perhaps, because here it is, you know, like 50 plus years later, not 50 plus, but in the range of 45 to 50 years later, and we're still doing that. And most of the people we knew at that time who shared in the overall enterprise or were involved in parallel things fell away at one point or another, and I either have no idea where they are or they moved on to other things and we've stayed in touch or not, whatever. But it seems as though we were more deeply entangled than we realized, and that it took many, many years to express that entanglement, to live it through.
Well, and do you think, I mean, you think of the books that North Atlantic published, which, you know, come later than IO Magazine, but as we've talked about, an extension of the work, essentially, similarly explored territory culturally and spiritually that I think in a serious way, has also marked change in the way that people actually live their lives.
Yeah, it sometimes seems so. Sometimes it doesn't when I look around, but other times it seems so. And North Atlantic Books, which is the successor to IO, is still thriving in a time when it's hard to do publishing. It's still alive, and if not quite at its peak, not that far below it, and still kind of pushing on a cutting edge of the same topics, which are psycho-spiritual, ecological, I guess mythological, anthropological, literary, and the convergence of them. Go ahead.
Well, you mentioned, I think, in the introduction to the anthology that North Atlantic Books has published 3,000 books, 3,000 titles.
Yeah, I wonder if that's true. I was kind of shooting from the hip, but when I said that, I did a rough kind of thing. Well, how many did we do in the 80s? How many in the 90s? And we had a number of years when we were doing 100 a year. At this point, 3,000 seems to be a little on the high side, but not out of the ballpark of what we published.
It
might be 2,000.
Right, but it's still a significant number of books. And yeah. So, well, let's talk a little.
Well, not for Random House, but for us.
Right. Well, but for any, I think any publisher who could look back and say, well, we published 2,000 titles, that's a lot of books. And, you know, even though it might be over a period of years, it's still, yeah. There are some, just a few little practical questions I wanted to ask, or questions about some of the practice of the work, because, you know, as I'm talking to publishers and magazine editors, I'm kind of interested in some of the mundane, the way things actually worked, you know, when you were putting together the magazine, maybe on your kitchen table. But in the early years, when you first started, presumably you knew nothing about production and printing. It was, you mentioned Kelly printing on a mimeograph. That was very common then as the technology of production, you know, in the 60s, that enabled a tremendous amount of publishing to occur that couldn't have been done otherwise. But you, the magazine that you did, IO, was quickly quite large in scope. I mean, it was much bigger than a lot of the fugitive literary magazines and that were pretty common then. So how did that work? You know, what were you doing? Were you using, I think in those early years, probably IBM Selectrix to type on a master and then print from there?
Yeah, initially we were much more formal. We actually, issues 1 through, I guess, 4, or even 5 maybe. Yeah, issues 1 through 5, we actually gave to a typesetter. And when IBM Selectrix became more commonly available, I began to type it myself. And that represented a severe drop-off in quality, for sure. But yeah. it also meant that it was something we're just doing ourselves. And then whatever we typed and pasted up, we sent off to the printer. And I went to graduate school in Ann Arbor, and I was surrounded by helpful printers who wanted our business, who wanted to show how to print our magazines. So,
to clarify for people who are listening who may not have seen early issues of IO, they were as printed as books. I mean, in the equivalent of a trade paperback. With a spine.
Sort of. They had a spine. They had a perfect bound spine.
Right.
But, you know, even that was like somewhat accidental. We first published issue 4, the alchemy issue, with a staple, and it didn't really hold together. The staples were coming out. So we had to change. I didn't even think of the idea that you could have a glue binding. that the printer suggested. I think the stapled one never appeared. After he tried it, he gave up, and he just said it's too big for a staple. And from then on, it was perfect binding. And then when North Atlantic Books started, is when we dropped back into formality. We had grants, as you well know from your own history, were available then, starting in the early mid-70s. And so we began sending the books out to be typeset. We didn't type them ourselves.
Right.
I was still typing IO, but the books were being typeset. And I think a huge breakthrough, we talk about accidental things, there are certain little seminal moments, and one of them in the development of North Atlantic Books was a time in the late 70s, I think around 78 or 79, when my Tai Chi teacher in San Francisco, Ben Lowe, announced that he had done a book with a few other Tai Chi teachers and wanted help in publishing it. At that point, I had not really published anything. Lindy and I had not published anything, either with I or North Atlantic Books, that wasn't 100% literary. And even the Tai Chi book, which was a translation of the Tai Chi classics in a way that looked like verse, could have been seen as literary, but it still was crossing a threshold there. And then an attendant feature to that was that they liked the outcome so much, and it reached so many more people than just their students, something they had not expected, that they then wanted to publish the works of their own master, the late Cheng Manqing, and wanted me to do it because it had worked out well. But they had a little proviso, which was that the girlfriend of one of the teachers, Martin Inn's girlfriend, Paula Morrison, had to be the designer. And I balked at that because I was used to our own method. But we hired her, and it wasn't long before we realized that, and she'd never had a job before. She was working as a cocktail waitress in San Francisco, but had taken a course on book design at UC Berkeley. And once she began designing the Tai Chi book, she began designing everything. And it really became, North Atlantic Books became a collaboration among the three of us, Lindy and I providing the content, and Paula being constantly on the cutting edge of what was possible in book design, right up to the point that we did one of the first books ever, sometime in the early 80s, that came directly from somebody's word program into a design program. We used some sort of interface that was available at UC Davis that they were developing individually, and the book didn't look that great, but it probably wasn't the first one ever done, but it was one of the first ones ever done. And Paula, for all the years she worked for us, and she only retired like 2 or 3 years ago, so it was a long, long period, always pulled the press along technically. We didn't have to do that ourselves.
No, that's a huge, huge differentiator between what you have done and what a lot of publishers have done, or independent publishers. I mean, similarly, probably learning by doing and accidentally learning how to publish books, in a commercially viable way. But I think you are lucky that, and of course, it seems like in a lot of ways, a lot of what happened in your publishing was accidental, but by virtue of your being open to the possibility and accepting, the changes that were happening, you were able to adapt and grow and become a professional publisher. Whereas when you started, I think that was unimaginable.
It was unimaginable. And And I wouldn't have said it at the time, but now I feel, without trying to be overly mystical about it, that it felt kind of channeled, as though I was getting higher intelligence guidance, because it just seemed that whenever it stopped working, something appeared out of the blue that pulled it along. And it was usually something, usually a very esoteric author or theme. And I felt sort of like there was a grace to it. And that created in me a mood that was very important, because I started off, I think, overly influenced by the kind of New York Jewish culture in which I had grown up, which was basically a kind of competitive and not terribly generous culture, subculture. And I, at a certain point, I crossed a kind of line and realized that the answer to making it work was not to hoard and to compete, but was to open it up and to try and give away and give back as much as possible. And it was both well-intentioned and strategic, and the two were almost inseparable. And it's on my mind now because another coincidence, the person who is running the press after Lindy and me had his first job with David a couple of decades back. So Doug Real, who we also share, and he finds a lot of the early contracts that I made really frustrating because they don't give enough margin in the present era. And that's true. They don't. They were created in an entirely different, mood and culture and economy, in which one felt free to improvise not only in terms of topics and technology, but in terms of contracts and deals and how you divided up the expenses and the earnings.
Well, in some ways, it occurs to me that what you've done in publishing through IO and then the press, you could track the kind of physical and economic issues obviously reflect the changing nature of publishing over that period of time. So when you your first distribution work for the magazine was with Book People through Terry Nemeth and others there who sought you out. That was really a counterculture development. It came from, they really started because the Whole Earth Catalog needed somebody to get the Whole Earth Catalog into bookstores. And as was very much the way kind of the hippie movement around the Bay Area was working then, people just invented structures to solve problems. So Book People was a co-op, an employee-owned business that lasted for quite a long time. They were the distributor for IO. But then for North Atlantic, this is the part I can't remember right. So was PGW your first distributor, or did you start distributing the books of North Atlantic through Book People and then move over?
Right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't even understand what the difference was between a wholesaler and distributor. And it would take many, many dialogues to go through all of the intricacies of that era, because the anthropologist in me notes how interesting it was that the generation that created Book People and made it an institution in Berkeley and the center of our publishing, especially once we moved there and worked hand in hand with them, which was very early in the game, and Publishers Group West, which was started by people 10 and 15 years younger than the people who started Book People, who had an entirely different view of the universe and the psycho-spiritual universe, the literary universe, the economic universe. I used to joke back at the time that we had gone from hippies to redneck hippies, because the PGW scene didn't have any of the trappings of the 60s and 70s counterculture, but it had a lot of the overlay of what I thought of the 1980s decadence. It was kind of riding the line between like the occult and pornography and or outright commerciality and consciousness and drugs played a big role in there for them. And I resisted it initially. It was like that was everything I was trying to get away from. And they had to court me for a long time. There were many years that I was virtually alone. And I say I because Lindy was doing other jobs then. But I was pretty much alone in refusing to let PGW put us on a distribution contract. I was one of those people grandfathered in at a wholesaler contract. And they kept trying to persuade me, and I kept refusing. And then ultimately, it became impossible to continue. And by then, I had sort of grokked what the difference between a wholesaler and a distributor was, and that a distributor was exclusive, and all your sales went through them, and they got a cut of all your sales. And he made it attractive enough that we gave it over to him.
Yeah, but when you say him, you're talking about
Charlie Wynn.
Right. Okay. He was the, for you, Charlie was the main person. I know that there were other people there, but But Charlie was your main contact and kind of the person who brought you into PGW.
Right. Well, other people brought me in, but Charlie was the person who kept trying to persuade me to come over. Like I still didn't think of publishing as a business. I thought of it as a calling, and as it had a kind of moral undertone to it that wasn't respected by the situation. They were only interested in the commerciality, and I fought that. But ultimately, I realized that I didn't have any other way to earn a living except the press. I wasn't teaching college anymore. I wasn't earning enough money from the books I wrote to earn a living that way. So I figured, well, this was painless. All I had to do was publish more commercial books, or publish books more commercially and do them in seasons the way he wanted and fill out his fact sheets and stuff. So I did I think life will secularize you in that way. And we had two young kids then who are now in their 40s, but we had a lot of expenses and no clear way to cover them, and that won me over.
So would you say, just in terms of the development of North Atlantic, and of course we note the irony that North Atlantic, because you started it when you were living in New England and you were near the North Atlantic, by this time you had moved to Berkeley, California, Oakland, Berkeley area, and mm-hmm. now you had North Atlantic Books based in Northern California, but you were kind of at the right place at the right time again, just in terms of the development of the independent distribution and publishing business. Because I think what happened with PGW and the, as you say, kind of the professionalization of distribution also coincided with, I think importantly, the growth of independent bookstores, so that from the
chain stores,
right, and well, of course, it's subsequent to the rise of the independent bookstores, you had Borders and Barnes & Noble becoming national chains of superstores with thousands of outlets that had to have books in them. So,
right, you have no idea. Well, you do, of course, but how big a change that made. Because we were publishing martial arts and holistic health as the primary items of our press. And the independent bookstores resisted those topics. And the publishers resisted them to a large degree, too. And when you got the combination of PGW and the chain stores and the actual market, which was huge for those topics. Suddenly, we changed from an organization that maybe ran a couple of $100,000 through us in a year to an organization which approached $1 million a year relatively quickly. I think the jump from $200,000 or $300,000 to the neighborhood of $1 million was a very quick jump of the jumps we made. And there were many subsequent jumps after we reached that level. But that was enormously driven by the fact that what we were already publishing, the chain stores were just made to sell. I mean, those martial arts books sold in incredibly large numbers. I can remember, I always knew George Plimpton because he was the nephew of my college president at Amherst, who gave us the money to start, Calvin Plimpton. And I remember talking to him at some point during those years and him just being amazed that we were selling the numbers of martial arts books that we were. It never occurred to him that market existed. And I'm not talking about books about fighting, you know, manuals. I'm talking about serious philosophical books on Tai Chi, Aikido, Capoeira, and other related martial arts like karate, taekwondo, and so forth. That was one of our early renaissances. And then somewhere in the later 80s, we got a huge boost from publishing The Monuments of Mars by Richard Hoagland. And that was a direct outgrowth of me writing The Night Sky for Sierra Club originally, and having Hoagland being in the Bay Area and us discovering each other, and then me inheriting his book, which had been sort of abandoned by Simon & Schuster at that point. And I took it over, and that became a huge bestseller for us for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And all of that got kind of channeled by Publishers Group West into the chain stores, and especially. And then, you know, if the era changed again and different factors came into play, it's changed many times since that chain store event of the 80s. It's changed many times over. It's changing again now into an almost unimaginably new form. But I think it changed during the later 90s and early 2000s into something that's not as easy to categorize. It's kind of pre-Amazon, pre-internet sales, when the usefulness of PGW as a distributor began to wane and the relationship wasn't working as well for us for all different reasons. I think that they kind of lost their impetus and edge, and we got a bit lost too. And it took a lot of things happening to give us a new and fresher edge. And we ultimately changed to Random House as our distributor, which was another big transformation point and boost in the publishing. But now I'm condensing too much too quickly, and I should let you ask your question.
No, that's all right. Well, I wanted to ask about the nonprofit and the distinction between take me through the history of at the time that you decided to form the press as a nonprofit, as a formal 501c3, and then I think you separated out the two different types of books, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, of course, that involves the intertwining of our own history, because at the time that we created the nonprofit was also, I think, roughly the time that you were the director of NEA Literature, and there was kind of a directive to get nonprofit status if you were getting grants. And at that time, the late 70s into the early 80s, we were getting grants, and they were a significant percentage of our revenue. And so we incorporated it as a nonprofit. But in doing so, we ran into the issue that that despite advice to the contrary, the IRS was not interested in granting nonprofit status for publishing, and we were turned down twice and had to rethink it. So I followed, we were led by Bay Area lawyers for the arts, and we made an anthropological nonprofit called the Society for the Study of Native Arts and Sciences, and donated the press to that. And that's how it got made as a nonprofit. Over the that was in 1980. And through the 80s, we attempted in all different ways to develop the nonprofit apart from the publishing, and we had very minimal success. I think our main success, well, I know our main success was in getting funded to run a capoeira program in the Oakland Public Schools through the National Endowment for the Arts, through the Folk Arts Program. But that was in itself an outgrowth of our publishing capoeira books by this one maestro who from Brazil who was in the Bay Area. But once we committed to a nonprofit, there's no going back. I won't go into all the ins and outs of that, but take my word for it. You do not want to go back on it, unless maybe you have millions of dollars and a very good lawyer. So at times we were tempted to want to undo it, but mostly I think we were nurtured by the nonprofit status because it meant we could publish as we wanted. We didn't have to pay taxes. The money could be from the books that work could be saved and put into other books which fit the mission of the kind of purest mission of the nonprofit. And we struck this really lovely balance between commerciality and nonprofit, in which we were publishing right down the core of our mission statement, and yet we're making enough money doing it to support the press. I don't think we could have done it through the 80s if we had also been a for-profit and had to pay taxes. And there are all sorts of intricacies about how that works with inventory valuation and so forth. But the nonprofit status made it relatively simple and straightforward to do. And we never really struggled with it until the early 90s when the State of California Franchise Tax Board began to audit us and complain about how we were operating and began asking us to do other activities beside the press. And that waylaid us for quite a few years until we had an organic farm in the Central Valley in California for about 7 years, which was a story in itself. And that satisfied the other requirements as they interpreted them. We also got new lawyers and a different board and reconceived the nonprofit so that we were more free to do publishing without the burden of having to do other activities. And I think what's most interesting about that at the moment is that after Lindy and I went through many years of simply publishing, I mean, we even went through a period where we created a temporary for-profit called Frog Limited. And we did pretty much identical books to the nonprofit. They might have been a little more commercial, but they were the same sorts of books. And it was an experiment that we ultimately ended for a variety of reasons. And then we donated the Frog Limited to the nonprofit also. But right now in 2015, almost 2016, the nonprofit has taken on a new meaning because the publication of books as books is under threat from so many different angles. That I think that most publishing companies, from the very large ones to the smaller independent ones, are going to have trouble continuing unless they change their template and way of doing business. It's very, very hard to work in an environment where Amazon is trying to maximize its margin, all that increase its margin, and is running a used book sale internationally, and in which so much free material is available on the internet. And Doug and the staff who are running North Atlantic are seeing the potential of the nonprofit and trying to reconceive the press and its overarching organization as a service organization which tries to participate even with different groups that we're not publishing in furthering the mission statement, which is basically a mixture of psycho-spiritual and ecological imperatives. It's about preserving wisdom and working towards human understanding and cultural transformation. And by kind of honing to the ideal of our nonprofit statement, we're in the process of, in some ways, reinventing the press as not just a press, but maybe as a real 501c3 educational organization. So, and that would be partly supported by doing other things like webinars and courses or what have you.
So, yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point. I suspect it sounds like a couple of other publishers have made similar realizations. But I wonder, and I kind of think that I've thought for a long time that the nonprofit world of theater is a good example, that in fact there are more nonprofit theaters, I suspect, than there are for-profit theaters. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if, in fact, the literary or all kinds of publishing, you know, as long as that publishing fits into a recognizable category. But I think the difficulty is for so many publishers there, they can't really do what you've done or what you've just described, which I think is really interesting. And that is, you broaden your mission, staying true to the values that you that you were founded with, but you're becoming a different sort of entity that includes being a publisher, but actually reinterprets the mission in light of the change in the way the publishing, the mechanics of publishing work today.
Yeah, there have been times in my life when I thought, why didn't I do something that was more commercial? I have a cousin who is a very big player on Wall Street, and he actually manages both the press funds and our own retirement funds. And I remember maybe about 10 years ago saying something like that to him, and him saying, "Well, you guys are happy. What do you need that you don't have?" He said, "The clients of mine who have the most money and are the most successful are the most miserable." And they often don't know what they want to do. More is never enough. They want to make more and more and more. And he said, "What do you need?" That was a really good insight, because I think it was merely kind of sloppy thinking on my part to sort of say, "God, why didn't I either do something that was more like remunerative than publishing, or if I did publishing, why didn't I do it in a more commercial way?" And none of that really would have had anything to do with what I wanted, because at the same time I've done the publishing, I've tried to do the practices. I trained as a cranial sacral therapist for 3 years. I have done Tai Chi since the 70s, not very well, but I've done it. And then since 08, I've been training with a psychic. And all of those things are like the key things in my life. They far transcend anything material. And when I just recently had to write my essay for our 50th year Amherst anniversary book, And I'm the editor of that, as I was at the 25th, because nobody else in the class is in publishing. And I basically said, well, you know, the main things that I value in my life are stuff that I didn't learn in school, in college or in graduate school. They're these initiations. And I think that that it's been for me a very delicate balance in which, if I weren't also being a writer and writing books which I've put a lot of myself, and developing these practices and doing the publishing, it would have fallen out of balance. And then other pieces of the balance are my relationship with Lindy, and because we've been married for almost 50 years now, and the raising of our kids, each of whom in their own work in a different way expresses the ideals and themes of the publishing in which they grew up as a sort of third sibling.
I think that's a really good summary of whatever, anything I could have asked you to summarize and finish the conversation you just did without me asking. That was wonderful. So thank you, Richard, for this really, really wonderful opportunity. I really like talking to you about all of this stuff that's part of my history and means a lot to me as well. So thank you for doing this. This Publishing Talks interview, David Wilk, your host, and I've been talking to Richard Grossinger about IO Magazine and North Atlantic Books. And subsequently, I will talk to Lindy Huff on the same subject. Thank you.
Thank you, David.